We had a truly perfect segue there at the end. Thank you for that great question about public transit. You might be hearing some similar and some divergent views from what were expressed on the last panel about how to think about public transit, but excited to think about transportation and decarbonization overall. So just to give a little bit of an introduction for myself, I'm Whitney Bauck. I'm a freelance journalist. I've written about all kinds of things sort of under the umbrella of climate, but I write about transportation and related issues for Bloomberg, for Grist, Rappler, which is a Filipino organization, and a bunch of other places. And I'm really excited to have what is literally a dream panel, and hopefully you'll see by the end why that is the case. So I know you heard some of this in the first section, but just to reiterate a little bit about why we're talking about transportation when we're talking about decarbonization. Transportation is responsible for 27% of U.S. carbon pollution, which is the largest of any economic sector. So we talk a lot about we need to move away from fossil fuels, we need to think about how to decarbonize our grid, and that is all true. But any conversation about decarbonization that is leaving out transportation is missing a really big part of the picture. And 85% of our transportation emissions come from like individual people driving themselves in private vehicles, which is a really like surprising number when you start thinking about all the ways that we think about, oh, this is industry's sort of problem, or this belongs somewhere else. Like this is a place where your readers probably feel like have a fair bit of personal connection to this problem. And so often when we talk about decarbonizing transportation, we talk about EVs, which I absolutely agree is part of the solution. It's definitely needs to be part of the conversation, but too often in the US, we sort of start and end there. We've seen that in federal policy, in the IRA, which created a lot of funding for sort of the electric vehicle transition and largely left out public transportation. Even though public transportation is in many ways a better or a more impactful option when it comes to actually reducing emissions, and I guess I'm including under this umbrella public transportation and also micromobility. So whether that's riding an e-bike, a normal bike, walking, rolling, sort of whatever option that might be. So a story that I did a few years ago on public transit and looking at how to make public transit more resilient to climate change, I was talking with Alex Engel of the National Association of City Transportation Officials, and he told me that a bus, even if it's diesel-powered, contributes fewer emissions per person than a private car that's an EV. And I thought about that so often because I don't know how much the general public knows that. Like, even if you are taking a bus that is still running on fossil fuels, it is having a lower climate impact than driving your own EV. So this is why we have to, you know, sort of have these conversations. And electric bikes are another thing that I think about a lot, have covered sort of the electric bike rebate programs in cities like Denver. But especially when we look globally, electric bikes and mopeds are cheaper to buy and run. They tend to be more accessible for a wider range of people from different incomes. And they're actually displacing four times as much demand for oil as all the world's electric cars at present. So this is not like a side issue. This is not like this should go underneath. This is really at the core of what we're talking about when we're talking about how to decarbonize this sector. So that's just to give a little bit of the framing, and then I'm going to let each of our panelists introduce themselves. And I'd love to have you each give like a pretty substantial intro, not just like your name and where you're from, but give people a real sense of why you're here and sort of how your career has led you to being the kind of person who gets asked to talk about this. We'll start with you, Burhan.
All right. Well, nice to be here with you guys in a room full of journalists. I'm sure that won't get me in trouble. My name is Burhan Azim. I'm a city councilor in Cambridge, Massachusetts. A little bit about me. So I originally have a degree from MIT where I studied material science and engineering. And that was really, you know, choosing that degree was really about me saying like, you know, I think we're the source of all the problems, whether it's like plastics and pollution, you know, solar cells, all those were really materials problems. And throughout that process, really learning that, you know, there's real political limitations to what we can do as well. And then later on, after working for a few years, I became, city councilor in Cambridge. And Cambridge in Massachusetts is a city of about 120,000 people. It's home to Harvard and MIT. And what's really, really nice about it is that it's a place where you have the politics and the finances and the practicality really work to align to see, like, what is the best that we can do in some ways, right? Like, we have 120,000 people, most of which, you know, overwhelmingly realize that climate change is a really, really big problem, that we want to be environmentally friendly. And then the question is, like, what can we do? And even in places where you have political alignment now, you end up having financial limitations, other sorts of practical limitations. And what Cambridge is really lucky in is that we have enough financial capacity that we can actually do the things that we commit ourselves to do. And that gives us a lot of, you know, place to experiment with policy, try things out, and really see, like, what is the effect of these, what works, what doesn't. And, you know, it's a really, really lucky and fun place to be. In terms of climate change, we've done a whole lot of things, right? From things that don't touch on the topic today, from having like an urban forestry program to really like add trees to, you know, every few steps on every sidewalk and reforest as much of our city as we can, to, you know, what we called BREEDO, which is a building energy reduction use, which is that all buildings in Cambridge have to be net zero by, or all of the buildings in Cambridge have to be net zero by 2035 and zero by 2050, and funding those programs as well. And then here really to talk about is our transportation emissions, right? I think that we had a really, really interesting policy taking place, which quite honestly, before we got elected, was how I thought government worked, which is like you run a policy, then you get elected, and then you do that policy. But what I learned after getting elected is that, like, at every step in the process, there's a veto point, right? There's, you know, public comment at every meeting where someone can have an opportunity to change your mind. There's, you know, you have to get approval for every single segment from the city council, from, you know, our system, a city manager, from city staff, from anyone at, like, state or federal government that want to intervene. And it really gives a lot of veto points. And so what we did was we said that we want to become a bike-friendly city. And I'll talk about why bikes over buses and other sorts of things, and really the limitations that you face in that. But we want to become a bike-friendly city. And so, you know, we wanted to build 26 miles of bike lanes within 5 years. And it comes at a very large cost, right? So we're talking about $200 million almost in investments for a number of reasons, because there's all sorts of other things that come with those bike lanes. But it has really been a rapid transformation where in, you know, the summers we see about 4 times the bike riderships as we do in the winter. And now this winter, we've seen more ridership in the winter than we did in the summer, like 5-10 years ago, right? So it's been transformational, and you really see a really huge uptake in ridership. And that it was our cycling safety ordinance, which says you have to build these, and anytime you redo a street, you have to add a bike lane. And so it's worth 26 miles in 5 years, but also a future permanent that every time we redo a street, we have to add bike lanes. And so that, among a lot of other things we're doing, adding, you know, e-bikes to our blue bike system, but actually we've been the last city, metropolitan area in the U.S. to do that. And so a little bit of learnings from that experience as well, among a lot of other fun stories.
That was great, right? Thanks so much for telling us a little bit more about you. Hi, everyone. I'm Kia Wilson, and my title is Senior Editor at StreetsBlog USA. StreetsBlog has been around since about 2006, back when we used words like blog instead of digital media. I want to say that I am an advocacy journalist covering the movement to end car dependency in the United States. That is not the movement to end cars in the United States, to be clear. I am very supportive of electric vehicles as a transitional strategy in many communities that need them. But it is more about scrutinizing the structural forces that make it so that about 70% of Americans get up every day, get in their car, and drive alone to work. And that way more people who are not counted because our survey instruments are pretty broken are getting in a car at other points in the day when they may not want to, may not need to, may not be able to afford to, and may not be served by it, either individually or collectively on the level of, say, our planet, right? And I came to this work in sort of an unusual path. I'm not formally trained as a journalist, big respect to everyone giving into J school. I came here as an advocate primarily. And my advocacy is rooted in a whole range of different experiences. Part of it is growing up in Ohio, where I was sprinting across a highway exit to get to my part-time job at McDonald's. And part of it was going to college in Santa Fe and working at a bike co-op where every single person on the bike stands next to me was an in-house person, and thinking about the intersections between mobility justice and housing justice movement. Another big touch point for me was losing loved ones to traffic violence, which is what I call car crashes. I don't use the term car accidents. I'm happy to talk about why if you'd like to find me after. Another big touch point for me was also being in St. Louis, Missouri, where I live, during the Ferguson uprising, and learning a lot about the intersections between our transportation ecosystem and structural racism in many communities across America. But I think probably the biggest driver for me, honestly, at the end of the day, is climate, because I think, as Whitney really beautifully attested, when we're talking about transportation sector emissions, we are talking about car emissions. We are talking about not just car emissions, I will say also, but also a whole wave of negative externalities that follow compulsory automobility when we don't give people a choice about how they get around, if they want to survive, if they want to get where they need to be on time, and all of the associated challenges that come with being mobile in America, which is not just about driving. So I'll leave it at that. I'm excited to be here.
Well, that was excellent. Hello, good morning. My name is Jerome Horn, and I need to start with this disclaimer before we continue. Here today, the things that I will say in this panel are not necessarily representative of my current employer or previous employers. I just have to put that out there. In my day job, I work for the Maryland Transit Administration, which is the primary transit operator for the city of Baltimore and the surrounding metropolitan area. I am the communications manager for the Baltimore Red Line Project, which will be a brand new east-west rapid transit line that we'll be building in the city. Prior to that, though, I've worked in transit consulting, working with cities all across the U.S. on transit plans. And then I previously worked for Indigo, which is the transit agency for the city of Indianapolis. And a lot of my roles have focused on public engagement, communications, and sort of the user experience of riding transit. Outside of my professional work, I also have become somewhat prolific in transit urbanist Twitter and online. I was one of the moderators for a Facebook group that used to be in its prime called New Urbanist Memes for Transit-Oriented Teams, or NUMTON. And that was this movement that kind of sparked in 2017 and really hit its stride sort of in 2020, and was a collection of hundreds of thousands of sort of 20 and 30 somethings and people older from primarily the United States, but all around the world, of people that were just really interested in cities and public transportation and questioning why the built environment is the way that it is. And really thinking about, you know, how do we begin to question and change the way things are. We mentioned that we may be sort of somewhat divergent from the previous panel. There was sort of this thing of, the United States, you know, the built environment is the way that it is. And it's been so centered around cars and automobiles, and it's just going to be that way. And, you know, we just need to accept it and move on, which, well, yes, to a certain extent, that is partially true. But I also think one of the things that I hope people take away from this discussion is that we should push against that notion. We should question why is it that we have to continue this way? The United States was not always this way. In fact, when many of our communities and cities were founded, they were inherently walkable. We had robust streetcars and tram systems throughout many of our cities, including Los Angeles, that at one point in time had the largest urban electric railway network in the entire world. And I think it's interesting that we see Los Angeles today has voted multiple times to fund public transit and is spending over $120 billion over the next 40 years to build out a light rail and metro and bus rapid transit network. And they also just recently voted for another measure that supports rolling out hundreds of miles of bike lanes and dedicated bus lanes in Los Angeles. So I do think there is appetite. We've also seen, the last thing I'll say, in Florida, there is Brightline, which is a sort of a brand new privately operated railway. And we talked more about that. But Brightline is kind of runs from Miami to Orlando, and they are breaking ridership records. People Coming to that train in droves and basically saying, hey, I don't want to sit in my car and drive, you know, on these highways. That if we, and it's, I think it's showing that, you know, if we provide people with viable options, they're safe, clean, and convenient, people are willing to take them. And we're also seeing ridership records being broken here in the Northeast Corridor on Amtrak. In fact, they basically are having to price the trains high enough to make sure that there are still seats open on a sort of a supply issue. But I say all that to say that there is an appetite if we, you know, make the investments, if we decide to prioritize non-car ways of travel. The last thing about myself, I live car-free. I've been car-free for about 3 or 4 years. I grew up in the suburbs. I drove everywhere, and I eventually just kind of had this awakening where I realized that I just wanted to be able to live a lifestyle where I didn't need a car. And so I primarily get around through walking, biking, and public transit. And it's my personal life mission to never buy a car ever again.
I love that. Thank you all so much. So in the national conversation about decarbonizing transit, as I sort of opened with, we tend to talk a lot about EVs. And again, there's definitely a role for that. And we've seen that sort of reflected in the federal funding. But I think you all are pretty well poised to talk about what we lose when we focus exclusively on cars and what we gain besides lowering carbon emissions when we expand sort of how we think about it. So could you all talk about sort of the, you've touched on this a bit, but go a little bit deeper on what do we lose when we focus exclusively on transitioning from one kind of car to another, and what do we gain when we sort of think beyond that box? Feel free to jump in, whoever wants to.
Sure, I'll start. So I'll talk from two different perspectives. One is the perspective of community, and then the second is like more from that national perspective, right? So from the perspective of community, you lose a lot of things, right? In that, like, you know, especially thinking from the perspective of cities, right? Like, A, cars are more less efficient in terms of getting around in terms of cities, right? You're going to have more traffic. You're going to have a lot more requirements in terms of parking and land use. You know, about 25 to 50% of our downtown areas or the metro areas of our cities ends up being taken up by parking. And that is really, really valuable land that could be used for other things. And, you know, it really has an impact on our cities in terms of like how they feel to walk around and all those sorts of things when you have really high car usage. They're also, you know, one of the leading causes of death for people, especially people between the 15 to 25 range is, you know, car crashes, right? And like, it is something that really, really has that negative impact. And there's the aspect of, you know, having community, you know, there's chosen community of things that you intend to do. And like, I'm going to make plans with this person and meet them there, or I'm going to go to church at this time. And then there's accidental community. You know, you're walking down the block and seeing someone that you run into before, or like having those, more unexpected encounters. And cars are one of the least efficient forms of that, right? When you're cycling, you know, at least other people can see you and you can go around. When you're walking, you can actually maybe have a small conversation. But cars really, really limit that and has those, all those terms of negative effects. And then from, you know, a macro, like nationwide or economic perspective, you know, besides just the land use limitation, it's really the most productive regions in the United States, right? The places where you'll get the highest wages, where you have the most jobs, where there's really demand. You know, one of the panelists said last time, I was like, you know, it's our job centers where, you know, like lower income people have to drive in there because that's where all the jobs are. Well, no major urban destination with a lot of jobs and opportunities primarily relies on car transit, right? It's just not efficient in terms of getting people along. And there's a lot of places in the world with much bigger cities than the United States. And all of those cities rely on some form of public transit, right? It's a really efficient way of getting people around. And I think that both for the health and future of our cities, both in terms of our economies and in terms of like creating, you know, safer places and more friendly places, like we really also have to think about other ways of getting around.
Yeah, to add to that, when you ask Whitney, what do we lose when we focus exclusively on EVs or over-focus on EVs, and then you can broaden that to that, the first thing that comes to mind is we lose the battle to decarbonize the transit sector. We do. The research that I have covered on this topic basically shows that to get to our sector goals, we would need to electrify 90% of the vehicle fleet by 2050. I'm sorry, to reach our sector goals without reducing how much we drive, I should say, in addition to all of the other challenges that were outlined in the previous panel. Even if we cut our travel by 20%, and even if we get to a honestly still pretty ambitious goal of 40%, we still lose. Most of the experts that I have talked to have said that we really need to be looking at cutting about 80% of our VMT in our major urban centers. That's the goal of cities like Barcelona right now. That's the goal of a lot of C40 cities, if you're familiar with that organization. And aim for at least like 30% nationwide. So that's the one thing, is it's just a mathematical and frankly cultural impossibility to get to the level of EV adoption that we would need to get to in order to make that our silver bullet, right? But then to build off of what Brennan said a little bit as well, I think that the downstream negative effects of automobility and car dependency are just so vast, and EVs only addresses one, which is the tailpipe. I did a write-up the other day of a research paper. A really ambitious young guy out of Scotland decided, I'm going to gather together all of the literature that I can find on the negative impacts of car dependency, and got to about 500 articles before his advisor had him stop because it is so vast. So I'm not going to take up this entire panel listing them all. I can link you to the summary, but one that I would certainly highlight is traffic violence. You know, NHTSA just put out the numbers, I think, like a week ago, 41,000 to 43,000 people tend to die on U.S. roads in car crashes. That's about 10 times the per capita rate of our less car-dependent industrialized peer nations, right? All of those deaths and all the serious injuries that we aren't even talking about today are avoidable. None of this. We've seen cities in the U.S. eliminate traffic fatalities completely. And one thing about EVs that is an inconvenient truth, I'm going to be dropping a lot of inconvenient truths today, is that because they are about 30% heavier than their gas-powered counterparts, force equals mass times acceleration, we expect the traffic fatality rate to rise with in tandem with the EV rate. And we need to have other systems of safety around the EV to prevent that rise from happening. We need to redesign our infrastructure pretty substantially. We need to invest in vehicle technology, which frankly right now is not where it needs to be. So yeah, EVs aren't a silver bullet, and we don't address all of the negative externalities of automobility that should be a feature of all of our coverage if we want to be more than just tailpipe journalists, if we want to be true environmental journalists that are going to be thinking about the entire human ecosystem as well.
It was so good. I'll just quickly say, and a lot of what we're highlighting is sort of like negative externalities, right, of EVs. I just want to uplift the human element. I think that is so important. When you're able to move around your community on a human scale, and what I mean by that is walking, biking, rolling, scooting, or taking public transit, you're more connected with the community. You're able to observe what's going on around you. You might notice a store that you've never seen before. You decide to go down a random side street and you discover that there's this really cool, you know, Victorian house that you think is the most awesome thing. Or as you're saying, you could be walking down the street and you just happen to run into a person who ends up becoming your best friend, right? There are a lot of things about when we are just inside of a car, regardless of how it's powered, that we're isolated. And that isolation, particularly in this country, in my personal opinion, has contributed to a lot of some issues we have with just having a great divide, because we all don't know each other, and we spend too much time being separated, and cars kind of allow us to be, oh, I move from my home, I get into my box, I go to my, you know, other box store or box office, and I, you know, only get to be around the people that I want to be around, which, you know, people have freedom of choice, but I do think that there's something human that we miss when we are able to be reminded that no, not everyone has the same opportunities as you, no. Everyone is, you know, has a different walk of life that, you know, people are facing different issues, and that shared humanity, I think, is something that we just miss when we focus too much on solely individual private cars.
I think having this conversation, for me, as someone who's based in Brooklyn, I can sometimes feel like almost guilty talking about it because I just have more public transit access, and more walkability in the place that I live than in a lot of parts of, especially of the US. And it can sometimes feel like outside of a few select sort of cities and corridors in the Northeast that the US is just like too locked into car dependence for me to really imagine it changing. I'd love to hear from each of you about solutions you've either seen or written about or been part of in terms of bills you're passing, that when it comes to communities or cities moving away from car dependency in one way or another, whether small or large.
I can start as not a resident of the coastal metro on this panel. So again, I live in St. Louis, Missouri, and I report on communities all over the country at StreetsBlog USA. And I thought there was actually a pretty telling answer in the last panel about how when we think about mode shift, which is what we're talking about here today, frankly, moving away from personal vehicle trips into personal, well, other vehicles, bikes, wheelchairs, mass transit, and things like that, we tend to jump right to this idea of car-free cities, which is like, whoa, there's a lot of steps in between. Car dependence, I like to say, is going to die a death by paper cuts because it was built, you know, one little bit at a time. We ripped out one trolley line at a time. We built one highway at a time until all of a sudden we got one day and we had a country where you really don't have much of a choice but to drive in a lot of context. So a lot of this stuff is really contextual. We're talking about things like, you know, Philadelphia, y'all were sued for your sidewalk network, and you're only going to be doing as a result of that lawsuit, curb ramp improvements over the course of, I think, the next 35 years. What about all of the things between the curb ramps? What about connectivity to get me when, you know, I was that rural Ohio teen to McDonald's across the street without having to, you know, beat my mileage time every single time I did it? I think we're talking about small tactical changes to infrastructure for the most part and to policy. We're talking about things like reforming jaywalking laws so that, you know, people of color don't have this massive pretext for police harassment hanging over their heads every time they leave their homes. We're talking about repealing helmet laws. We're talking about the kinds of projects and policy shifts that don't get a ribbon cutting, that aren't exciting to a lot of journalists, but they should be. And the role of journalists in, I think what you all can really do is to uplift those projects and those policy changes as transformative, because they really are. And some of these changes, like culture, you know, I've seen a lot of good done in small communities around organizing group rides, getting people out for group walks, even out on biking and walking to experience what it is like to move outside of a vehicle in the safety of a pod, frankly. And then that turns people into advocates over time. So yeah, I think a lot of the time our imagination gets really stifled by this idea that when we're talking about sustainable transportation, we're talking about public transit, we're talking about plopping down a SEPTA in the Wajak, Michigan, which is where my mother lives. It's a town of 3,000 people. We're not going to do that in most places. But what we can do is we can look around and say, hey, where is the grocery store within a 10-minute walk of my dad's condo in rural Ohio, if there were a path to get there, if he didn't have to drive the 1 mile long around the way. So yeah, it's looking at those really small tactical changes and then systematizing them into large programs that make these our norm.
Yeah, Kate, you made a really good point. I was going to highlight that of, you know, you can, you know, look at a map or pull up Google Maps, look at satellite image, and, you know, you'll always see, especially in the suburbs, communities where you have, you know, single family homes, and then there's some woods, and then there's a grocery store right there, but it's only like 500 feet away, but you can't, there's no possible way you could walk there, right? And I think that's so important. Like that, those are little things that we could do. When I lived in Indianapolis for 7 years, Indianapolis is definitely not the first place that comes to mind when you think about walkability or transit or progressivism. But, you know, we in Indianapolis, we passed a transit ballot measure where 60% of public voted for public transit. We rolled out the nation's first battery electric bus rapid transit line. And they're continuing to expand and doing sort of the Indianapolis Cultural Trail, which is this really sort of robust, very, I'd say one of the best in the country bike trail networks that really runs through downtown Indianapolis and then connects further out into bike greenways that take you way out of the city into the surrounding counties. And, you know, some of the surrounding counties, I have a lovely relationship, but there is a town called Carmel, Indiana, which is the roundabout capital of the U.S., if not the world. But, you know, they are doing some really interesting things in terms of being a suburb where they have recognized, you know, we actually want a town center that people want to come to, and they are investing in sort of expanding their bike lane network. And I've seen examples of this in Bloomington, Indiana, where I went down a lot when I lived in Indianapolis. And other smaller cities are really thinking, you know, how do we allow for people to experience their community once again on that more human level? And so a lot of it is around giving people a safe option to bike or walk. Alpharetta, Georgia, which is a suburb north of Atlanta, is building out a sort of this bike and greenway trail network. And they've also rebuilt their sort of traditional Main Street downtown. And it is the most popular thing. I mean, if you'd gone there 20 years ago, you wouldn't believe what you see now. And everyone just loves to be there because they get to walk around and they get to see other people. Those are all like policy decisions that were made and sort of the vision of leaders in that town going, well, how do we as a suburb or a smaller town fit into this conversation? And once again, yeah, it's not, you're not going to come in and, you know, build a subway or a light rail everywhere, but you can just simply give people safe places to walk and bike.
Yeah, those are some really great answers. I want to kind of going a little bit of a different direction, right? Like the question was like, is the U.S. like too far gone in some ways, right? Like we have like walkable transit oriented places where we have them, and like in the places we don't, is there hope? And in like the ways that we have, like maybe we're at capacity, right? Like it's not, it might get a little bit better, but not a lot better. And I think that I have like a few quick thoughts, right? Like just like a mental framework first is like, you know, even if we just focused on urban areas, like the disproportionate population really has a high impact. I'm sure you guys have seen a map of like LA County is bigger than like half the states in the country, right? Like, you know, a lot of people live in our urban areas. So even if we're only focusing on that, that can have a huge impact on tens, if not hundreds of millions of Americans, right? Like it really is a power law distribution of where people live and, you know, where we can make these transit and the density already exists to work them. The second point is that I think, in my view, like there's some, you know, proactive like changes in legislation that we fight for that really will help move the ball needle. But it's also about just balancing the playing field from the first place, right? Like parking minimums are common in almost every state in the country, right? Which says that you have to have a parking lot on a property. And it's deeply unfair to people who don't have a car, right? Like, it's one thing, like, you know, other people use the roads, they should benefit from them, even if I don't use them, the same way we have with schools and all sorts of things, right? Why do I need a parking lot on my property if I do not own a car, right? Like, this is something that adds, you know, between where you live, between $30,000 to $300,000 of cost to that homeowner. But everyone is forced to have one in most places in this country, even if they do not have a car, right? And it's like things are moving like that, that like actually are prohibitive in terms of people, you know, like choosing to transition, right? Like I think that we are more car oriented than we need to be, not because of like all the infrastructure and all those sorts of things. Like I think those will be limitations at some point, but also because we do not let people really choose freely without tipping the scale heavily in terms of economic incentives, right? Like when you're a homeowner, you have this $100,000, $200,000 worth of property that, you know, $200,000 that you've spent on this property where you have that parking lot, and you're like, well, now it's free for me to use, so I might as well use it. But if instead you could use that $200,000 and do something else with it, you know, then maybe you can live a different sort of lifestyle. And then I would say to the third point, you know, I think it's really about thinking about margins, right? Like, you know, a car really is really helpful in terms of it can do everything, right? Like it can get you from A point A to B in the country, kind of almost regardless of where you are. And I think of it like a laptop. Like a laptop is really powerful. You can do all the things that you need to do on it. But sometimes a smartphone is kind of just enough. And we are a lot of those instances, right? Like maybe you're someone who doesn't work, right? You're either a kid or a retiree. And your main thing, if you're retiring, might be just like I want to get groceries. And so having a walkable grocery store might actually remove your emissions for, not for everyone, right? But maybe you actually don't need a car most of the time, because most of what you go outside for is just to go and get groceries. And maybe your neighbor is your friend. And so like that kind of fills your social circle. And so now that's, maybe a percentage or half a percentage of people, but it's, it's by bits and pieces, or if like your local mall is allowed to be near and you have that mixed zoning where you can have a mall where you live, maybe if you're 16 or 17, you actually don't need a car then, right? Because like you actually don't need to drive to see your friends. You guys can just go to the local mall, which is walkable. And all of a sudden you have like 16, 17 year olds who don't need to get a car, and then they go to college and they haven't had a car before. And like there's all these sorts of things. And it was really in these percentages of like all the things that we make it so you need a car from, requiring separated uses, so you have to walk to all these mandates that really kind of assume that everyone has a car built in. And I think that even before we get to incentivizing all sorts of other transit, just removing the barriers to living that sort of lifestyle would do a huge amount of the work.
Yeah, that's great. I want to try to go quickly through the sort of remaining questions so that we can open it up to you all and do want to hear from you on what you're interested in. One thing I would love to hear a quick answer from any of you on is where disability and accessibility fits into this conversation. I find that often when I talk to my friends and colleagues in other parts of the country about like one of the reasons I love living in New York is that I don't own a car. In a lot of ways, I actually feel like it's more convenient not to own a car where I live because parking is a pain in the butt because we're incentivizing it slightly less than we do in some other parts of the country, although many of my neighbors would still say we're incentivizing it too much. But I'll hear people say things, well, like not everyone can walk, or in New York City, like a lot of our subways are not wheelchair accessible at all. We literally don't even have elevators. Like you have to be able to take the stairs, and things that hurt disabled folks hurt all of us at some point. Like if you've ever hauled luggage, if you've ever pushed a stroller, you know it's a real pain in the butt, even if you can walk. To not have a sort of option. So I'm curious how you all think about that and if you have any sort of quick ideas on that front to share.
I'll just add quickly, there's many different types of disabilities. Like I think that that is certainly true for a subset of people. Like, if you can't walk, then maybe, walking as your mode of transit is not working. But also, there's people who are blind or are amputees and all sorts of other people who just can't drive, right? And what's like nice about subways is that like, you don't actually have to do anything. It's a passive experience. You get on and it'll take you where you need to get to. And like, that's just for subways, but like there's a lot of different sorts of disabilities and trade-offs in all the different modes of transit.
Yeah. And just to put a stat to that, like, first of all, 40% of people with disabilities cannot drive. It's not a small subset of it when you really break it down. And that is just accounting, layer on top of that, 30% of U.S. adults don't have a driver's license when you include children, when you include, and that's probably actually a conservative estimate because there are a lot of people who should not have a driver's license who do, frankly. I know you want this to be a short answer, but actually, if I had been a little bit more extensive in my introduction, one of my whys, the why I come to this work, is because I'm a person with invisible disabilities. I have a chronic pain condition that sometimes makes it challenging to walk. Biking is actually the best mode of transportation for me. And then I got a little touch of a CPTSD from the work that I do, talking to people about the sudden violent death of their loved ones almost every day of my work. And yeah, as you said, the disability community is not a monolith. And I think that the compassionate side of me wants to say that there's a whole lot of people who the only disability accommodation they know of in the transportation realm is that stamp on a parking space with a picture of a person in a wheelchair. The spicier side of me wants to say that a lot of people like to use the disability community as cover to argue for greater conveniences for able drivers. And when you scratch the surface, even a tiny, tiny, tiny bit, that is not actually the community that they're advocating for, frankly. People with disabilities, the little tiny bit of data that we have on it, because again, our survey instruments are really broken on this, people with disabilities are far more likely to be killed in what we call pedestrian crashes, whether or not they're actually getting around on 2 feet. We do include people in wheelchairs, people using other assistive devices under that umbrella. And that's for obvious reasons, because no one really at the end of the day is going from their home to a other location with no interference with the outside world. You still have to at least get from the parking lot to your destination, which, by the way, our national fatality stats stats do not include about 2,500 people who die in parking lots every single year, just to lay one thing out there. Automobility doesn't serve anyone. And I would say that it serves disabled people the least in a lot of ways. If you want to talk about wheelchair accessible vehicles, that's going to bring you north of like $100,000 a lot of the time. And people with disabilities are among the most likely to be living in significant poverty. And I also add that like the preferences of people with disabilities matter. Like there are people with disabilities who care about climate change and don't want to drive for their own reasons. There are people, you know, as we've highlighted throughout this panel, people with disabilities who want to connect with their neighbors and be in society. And we've invisibilized the disability community and we speak for them a lot. So I'll leave it at that. I could give an entire panel just on this topic and we'd love to talk about it more.
I'll just say quickly, related to this, aging in place, people are living longer. There's a point where maybe people shouldn't be driving anymore, but continuing to drive because either where they live, that's just the reality that they face. And I think, you know, one of the things that we'd like to see by investing in things that aren't just EVs and thinking about other ways to allow people to get around is thinking about, as people get older, how can they age in place? How can they age gracefully? How can they still maintain some form of independence when they are no longer able to drive? And I think that's increasingly going to become something that we're going to see as people are, you know, living longer lives. And we need to account and think about it. I think about my parents who, still have hopefully, you know, a decade or two more of being spry, but they live in a cul-de-sac in the suburbs and drive everywhere. And I do ask them, well, what happens? What are you going to do in this three-story house and cul-de-sac? Like when you can no longer drive, what's the plan? What are you going to do? And that's something we really need to think about.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen that firsthand too. Just I had a grandmother in Kansas, and as she aged, you know, she lived in this small town that she loved. She knew people well. She felt loved and known and embedded in a network of community there, but she needed to drive to get anywhere. It's totally one of those places where the grocery store is not that far away, but you can't actually safely get there on foot. You have to drive. So she wasn't able to stay there as she got older and older. Like she needed to move to go be near family because she needed people bringing her groceries. Whereas I made a friend who was 93 when I met him in Brooklyn, and he was still largely independent because he could walk to the grocery store and he could walk to his doctor's appointment and he could still walk around because he lived in a very walkable community even as he got older. So I feel like I've seen some of that firsthand. I have more questions that I could ask you all, but I really want to open it up to the audience. We'll sort of give our standard disclaimer of every time of, you know, sort of journalists to the front. Please, we'll sort of let journalists go first. Please state your name and your affiliation. And yeah, so anyone I'll go for you first?
I'm Audrey with the Scrub. I'm a freelance writer, semi-retired, and I haven't ridden a bike or walked for since the Klan, my hip when I was 17. And I find your comments about dismissing those of us who have difficulty walking somewhat offensive and a lack of knowledge of these conditions. You mentioned senior citizens aging in place. My mother is 100. She can still drive to her doctor's appointments and to the store. She can't walk that far. And you're just dismissing those of us who have difficulty doing things over different distances just because you can.
I'm not sure that comment's directed to me, but I want to respond to it. And first, I want to say I'm really sorry to hear about your experiences. That's terrible. And it's a big part of why I do what I do, is because stories like yours have touched me a lot. I want to clarify again, I am a person with mobility and disability. And say that I am trying to elevate the needs of those who have disabilities that make it impossible for them to drive. That is not me excusing at all. Elevating the needs of people who need a car. I think that compulsory automobility makes it harder for people who rely on cars as an assistive device to access the things that they need. it makes land use so much more challenging to confront when every single person is using what is for some people a lifeline as a means. It makes our destinations further apart. It makes life more expensive. And it also makes the journey from the car to the doorway so much more challenging. It is not my intention at all to dismiss what your experiences are, because frankly, I share them in some ways. And the ones that I don't, I really need to make an effort to uplift them. I'd love to talk to you about this more, if you'd like.
Just chime in. Thank you for sharing. And also, yes, I mean, that was a terrible experience. And I appreciate you being vulnerable and letting us know. I want to be clear, at least speaking for myself, I'm not anti-car. I'm anti-car dependency. And there's a difference where we know that, as the last panel said, and as we've mentioned, there is a reality that for at least the foreseeable future, for a while, there will be people that need to drive an individual car in different parts of the country. That's just a reality. However, I think what we're trying to say is that it doesn't have to be that way, and not everyone needs to drive a car, and that there are a lot of car trips that aren't necessary or could be lessened. Or we could get people to live a, you know, experience a lifestyle that depends less on a car for every single trip. And for those that need to drive, if we can get less cars on the road, hopefully that makes it safer for everyone that's out there, regardless of how they get around. But I don't want us to come off as insensitive or that we're completely dismissing those who do need to rely on their vehicle primarily. The real conversation, though, that we're trying to push here is, you know, why is that the case? Could we do better? How do we get there?
If I might chime in, I think that, I don't know the details of, your particular experience. But I would say, to put it tangibly, about what I think people are advocating for is, if you lived in a place where instead of, having to leave your house, drive to, a doctor's office and then get out right there and then walk, right? But if you could leave your house, take a bus, and then it would stop you in front of your doctor's office and then you could get out, right? Or if you could leave outside your house and then take a subway and then it would drop you right in front of your doctor's office and then get out, right? I think that it's a little again, I don't know your circumstance. I'm not trying to speak to it in particular, but I would say that it's car dependency or being required to have a car, when I said is the laws require it and our land use is kind of built up for it in a way that those options aren't really options for people, right? I understand completely, my own dad can't walk for more than 5 minutes at a time, right? And he lives in Staten Island, New York. And so he drives many places, but he also takes the bus and takes us, we only have one train line, so less frequently the train, but really the bus a lot of places as well. And it's because, in some places in Staten Island, you can get from one place to another with the bus, and that works fine for him as well. And the point is that, a lot of the assumption of not having enough public transit is that, the places are set up in a way that you need to drive because the density is not there in both places to sustain public transit. But if we did allow density in both of those places and the numbers work out, you could have a direct bus lot from where you are and where you need to be in a way that, a bus and a car are not that different in the sense of you're in the same vehicle. It's just whether you're driving yourself or someone is driving you and you have those density in numbers.
Yeah, I think some of what I'm hearing is that there's a desire for choice so that people have an option of do they take a car or do they take a bus or do they take a train or can they walk or can they bike? And for some people, they might say, actually, only one of those choices works for me and for my situation. But I think that what I'm hearing from the panel is wanting to create a range of choices so that people can choose the thing that works for them. Because it might be true that someone says, really the only thing that's going to work for me is a car. And we want to be able to say as a society, you should be able to drive a car. And someone else says, I literally can't drive a car based on my ability. And we want to say to them, we still want you to be able to leave your house and go be part of society, even if you can't do that. So I think that's just to sort of sum up what I'm hearing. Any other questions? Go for it.
My name is Kyle. Once again, I live here, fellow freelancer. I'm doing my best. I've got the e-bike I got an accident. I still strap my one-year-old to it and hope for the best. I try to take the regional rail, the bus, as much as I can. Safety, reliability, cost concerns with that. So I guess sometimes I just wonder, should I just buy the Chevy Bolt and just put my eggs in that basket instead? But I also write for Grid, which is a big environmental magazine in the city, so I do have a platform. What kinds of stories should I be doing? Questions? Who should I be asking questions to? How could I potentially move the needle to a better environment in Philly?
I can start on that one. I would say engage with the advocacy organization. So when you say I'm an advocacy journalist, what I interpret that to mean is I cover advocacy movements. I cover organizations like Transportation for America. We've mentioned the National Association of City Transportation Officials. I am engaged with, I think, Center Square, is that what it's called? Fifth Square. I was like, there's a square in there. That's the first local Philly one even written about Philly that I've engaged with most closely. I would say work on with the people who are working on this issue and highlight the issue cuts that are on circling through the news cycle because there is one every single day. I write 4 to 6 articles a week for Streets Blog, and I will never run out of articles in my life because the challenges of confronting car dependency are that big. So the strategy that I always recommend to journalists who want to be doing more of the kind of stuff that I do all the time is follow the news cycle. You know, if I were in Philly this week, I'd be writing about how the heck is everybody getting less money, you know, as a joke. But yeah, engage with your local advocacy movements and they will never steer you in.
I'll say quickly, in the previous organizations I worked for, Transit Center, it's a sort of national transit advocacy policy and research group. And they put out a lot of great reports talking about transit and some of the challenges of transit in the country. But one thing that was recently released, I can't remember the name of it, but if you go to transitcenter.org, they have all of their publications. It's kind of this communications toolkit. And they kind of went around the country, had focus groups, brought in a lot of people who did use transit, didn't use transit, people across political spectrum, age spectrum, all sorts of demographics, to really kind of look at what is the messaging that resonates with people? What does it take to get people to support public transit, or what are the concerns people have about public transit? But that field guide that they came out with, I think is really good. And kind of lays into, some of the way you construct a message and talk about how, you know, we all value clean air and communities, and no matter who we are, we want to be able to move about, you know, our city freely and talking about that. So I think that's a really good resource to look at that field guide from Transit Center.
I'll just add in a few sentences that I think that the way that change happens, like dramatic change or transformational change, is like ideas on the table meets a crisis or a particular moment in time. And it's like, you know, political world is really hard. It generally tends towards moderation as much as possible because that's how you upset the least number of people. But every once in a while, you have the right coalition naturally emerge or some sort of event that causes a lot of focus. And in that moment of focus is not when you come up with ideas. It's when you look at the ideas that have been lying around in the discussion and you pick one and you run with it. And so I feel like, you know, from being on the other end of it, being in politics and like thinking about both, you know, Cambridge local politics, but on a state level, how do we improve our MBTA? You know, our MBTA went on fire, was like the most dangerous like subway station system in the US and all those sorts of things. And like the ideas that end up being spoken are the ones that like are both the people in the advocacy space, also like professional staff, but also journalists have been like toying with and talking about and giving airtime to all the time. And like, I think that, you know, that's not an answer to, you know, I think they gave much more direct answers, but just like a framework that I think about a lot.
Just really quickly, our 95 went down last year and it was a chance for public transportation. Yeah, this is our moment. Take the train, do that. And then the governor came in and like made it the crisis of the year and fixed 95 in a week and never happened.
We'll do what the list.
So David Ferris, I write for E80 News and I have a question about bike lanes and the infrastructure that's being created for scooters and bicycles. I live in Seattle, and that's a big bike and scooter town. But I do notice that if you're not in sort of a Goldilocks situation, you know, if people don't go if it's too hot, they don't go if it's too cold, they don't go if it's too wet, they don't go if it's too dark, And so, like, people are out there when it's nice, but what the many, many times it's not nice, they don't. And people kind of seem to prefer the hard shell of a vehicle. And I just wanted to see whether there's any, is there any kind of, like, thinking around the fact of how kind of vulnerable to simply to the elements this you know, supposedly crucial link of infrastructure is?
Sure, I can talk about it. So, you know, in Cambridge, we've added like 26 miles of bike lanes, and I think we really are towards the tail end of our installation in a way that I can kind of talk about the results. And, you know, Cambridge, as you can imagine, being near Boston, is like pretty cold in the winter. It's been raining all of April. I have a couple different answers. One is that, like, you know, on the more like optimistic side, like, the bike lanes really do make a difference, right? And bike lanes, it's like for all the different e-mobility devices, but like we now have more people riding in our winters by like huge margins than we did when in our summers before we began the bike lane installation. So like there's a pretty dramatic difference in ridership you see. I think the second is that, like, you know, it depends on how exactly bad the weather is. Like, you know, in really, really bad weather, whether it's icy weather or things like that, people choose not to drive or do a bunch of things. I think bicyclists are much more vulnerable to that than cars, and that's no doubt. But like if it's light rain or like those sorts of things, people develop ways to kind of adjust themselves to it, right? Like in Boston, it's cold. And so, you know, even here I have like thermals on, and like those are some like sorts of things that people adjust to. And I think that, you know, the most direct answer is like, I think that it's like something that's like not for everyone all the time, but it really does figure, it's like part of our transit solutions. There's a whole bunch of people who, you know, really, really do kind of make it work. And I think of them as sidewalks. When you have bike lanes that are safe as sidewalks, even if it's raining, you can kind of make it work. And if you have bike lanes that are as safe as sidewalks, some people will still choose not to go out because like the elements are really harsh and all those sorts of things. But you can make it work, and we have increasingly seen a large number of people do make it work in practice. And I think that having mobility options for people who like are uncomfortable in those that are other mobility options are still an option. And that's why it's like, you know, you're not going to replace every street with only bike lanes, but having other ways to get around for people when they're facing those difficulties is important. And I'll just finally add, like, the numbers have been pretty stark. So we've seen about 10,000 people start biking who did not before the bike lanes. And I would just say, like, how much of a difference it makes that we took 10,000 cars off the road, that even as we added 30,000 residents, we've not added any new net cars. And I feel like that, in terms of creating space for cars, for emergency vehicles, and all those sorts of things, like, it makes it easier for everyone else to get around, because I can only think about how bad the congestion would be with all those people as well. And so the real answer is, I think of it as a yes and conversation. It's definitely a real limitation. And hopefully someone will be innovative and, like, mopeds or something will, like, fill in that gap. But like I think it definitely like makes it easier and it's like walkable to some extent.
Yeah, just to add a couple more things to that, I wanted to say driving goes down during inclement weather too. I think that we are much more sensitive to changes in weather-related travel disruptions on the bike lane, because it is new, it is novel, it is someone who's often sitting physically a little bit taller. But yeah, as part of Streetsville USA, I often will cover places not in the USA as a way of saying, hey, how about we do this? How about we borrow this idea? Think of expanding the national imagination about what cities can be. Look at Finland, look at the Netherlands, look at Canada, look at cities that have created a culture of cycling that is so robust, where they have mottos like, there is no bad weather, there's only bad clothing. Look at places that have created snow clearance policies on their bike lanes, or, you know, on their sidewalks as well. I would highlight, like, Holland, Michigan has run like an entire system, like snowmelt system, under their sidewalks. It's incredible. So that, like, we clear the paths for people first before we clear the paths for cars. We make sure that it is safe for them, because the reasons why people don't bike, walk, take transit in inclement weather that are specific to those moments have to do with policy and the policy levers that we can pull. So yeah, I would push back a little bit against the supposedly essential transportation. We don't treat biking and walking and system of the transportation as supposedly essential, but even a little bit essential. We don't prioritize them. And since we did, we would probably see a lot more people out in the bad weather. And we would, of course, it would never be universal, because I stay home and I don't drive when there's a thunderstorm too.
Can you hear me? I'm a senior journalism student at Temple University here in Philly. And so I have a question for all of you, whoever can answer. What would you say to people who care about the environment, but safety is a major concern when taking public transportation, or if they experience transit anxiety, which I actually just found out about, that some people get really anxious when they take subways, or the septic system? It looks like a prison in, like, the subway. It's really dark. They have, like, really weird cages and, like, weird corners of, like, the subway system. And I guess, like, what would you say to people that do care, but, like, they're just a little scared?
And I think this needs to be a really brief answer as much as you guys can.
Okay, I'll start as the public transit person. Yes, this is absolutely true, especially on our older systems, and particularly when you talk about subways and you have to go underground into a chamber, basically. There are definitely things that transit systems we can do to try to make the environment more inviting, right? Whether that's through new designs, better lighting, thinking about, you know, the perception of safety and the reality of safety aren't necessarily the same thing, but they do matter, and the perception can matter even more than the reality. So that is absolutely true and about it, that people, you know, do think about safety. And of course, depending on how you show up in the world, your identity, and how you move through space, whether you're someone who is a person of color or woman or identifies as female or queer, you know, those things also matter too, to how people feel about moving around public space. But one of the things is that, you know, the people we get in public space, the better things usually are. You know, especially if you go down to the subway and you're the only person on the platform, there's only one other person on the platform, yeah, you're going to feel kind of vulnerable. But if you have more people around, right, more eyes on the street, as we like to say, that does make a difference. And people generally feel safer, you know, navigating different environments. But it is true that we do have work to do when we think about how we design systems, how we plan for transit amenities and things like that. How do we cater to and think about users and how users might experience the system. So I guess I'd say, you know, one of the things we need to do better, right, is get more diverse people making these decisions and designing these systems, because most of the built world that we see today has been designed for and by men for the most part.
I'll just take 10 seconds and say that, like, one hand, like, I just want to reiterate, like, the stats of, like, you're much more likely to get hurt in a car accident than in any subway system or like train or bus system. That doesn't mean it's perfectly safe, but, like, by and large, like, much, much, much safer than driving yourself. And then I think more directly, like, I think that one thing that I think about from a policymaking perspective is, like, I think that we have this tendency to think about public transit as an anti-poverty program. And, like, I don't think that's helpful. Like, obviously, like, having low fare programs or, you know, free options for people who don't have enough money is very important. But, like, investing and thinking about public transit is something that, you know, it's competing against that, like, $50,000, $60,000 car that you would buy. And you need, you know, a high level of investment to make it a really nice, professional, well-run, like, alternative to that, right? Where people invest a lot of money in, like, their own private vehicles. And I think that the best systems in the world are also the most safe, most efficient, and the most well-invested in, and are generally taken by a large segment of the population.
Yeah, I think we got to wrap it there. Thank you all so much. I really appreciate your contributions. I think my takeaways, and that I hope you all would take away, is that this isn't about, this is a sort of framing that comes up a lot in environmental journalism, like, the environmentalists are trying to take your hamburgers away. They're trying to take your cars away. And I hope that what you're hearing from this panel is, like, this is about creating options for people. It's not saying you can't do this anymore. We're going to make it impossible for you to do this thing that you grew up with or you're so comfortable with. It's about saying, what if you had options? What if your town had options? And I think wherever you are in the country, whether you're in a red, blue, purple state, thing that people are very open to hearing, because people want options to figure out what works for their life and their family. And that's some of what I think this conversation is about. So thank you to all of our panelists. I think after this, you can run, get lunch, and then bring your boxed lunch back here. We're going to have the last panel is on congestion pricing, which, if you are not paying attention to this conversation, I think it is absolutely crucial for thinking about what public transit might look like in the future. It's something that's been happening in a lot of other countries, and we're sort of piloting it here in New York, and it could have large impacts for the rest of the country. So see you after the break, and give a hand to our panel.